Laddie whirled back in a storm of sand and dropped the damp stick in front of him. Victor picked it up and threw it again. Laddie bounded off, yapping himself sick with excitement. "Well, yeah," said Gaspode, ambling along in a bow-legged swagger. "Only I can look after myself. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. You think Dorpy the Mutt there would last 5 minutes in Ankh-Morpork? He set one paw in some of the streets. He's 3 sets of fur gloves and crispy fried number 27 at the nearest Clatchy and all-night carry-out." Victor threw the stick again. "Tell me," he said, "who was the famous Gaspo you're named after?"
"What, you never heard of him?"
"No."
"He was dead famous."
"He was a dog?"
"Yeah. It were years and years ago. There was this old bloke in Ankh who snuffed it, and he belonged to one of them religions where they bury you after you're dead. And they did. And he had this old dog."
"Called Gaspode?"
"Yeah. And this old dog had been his only companion, and after they buried the man he lay down on his grave and howled for a couple of weeks, growled at everybody who came near, and then died."
Victor paused in the act of throwing the stick again.
"That's very sad," he said.
He threw. Laddie tore along underneath it and disappeared into a stand of scrubby trees on the hillside.
"Yeah. Everyone says it demonstrates a dog's innocent and undying love for his master," said Gaspode, spitting the words out as if they were ashes.
"You don't believe that, then?"
"Not really. I believe any bloody dog will stay still and howl when you've just lowered the gravestone on his tail," said Gaspode.
There was a ferocious barking.
"Don't worry about it. He's probably found a threatening rock or something," said Gaspode.
He'd found Ginger.
The librarian knuckled purposefully through the maze of Unseen University's library and descended the steps towards the maximum security shelves. Nearly all the books in the library were, being magical, considerably more dangerous than ordinary books. Most of them were chained to the bookcases to stop them flapping around. But the lower levels, there they kept the rogue books. The books whose behaviour or mere contents demanded a whole shelf, a whole room to themselves. Cannibal books. Books which, if left on a shelf with their weaker brethren, would be found looking considerably fatter and more smug in the smoking ashes next morning. Books whose mere contents pages could reduce the unprotected mind to grey cheese. Books that were not just books of magic, but magical books. There's a lot of loose thinking about magic. People go around talking about mystic harmonies and cosmic balances and unicorns, all of which is to real magic what a glove puppet is to the Royal Shakespeare Company. Real magic is the hand around the bandsaw, the thrown spark in the powder keg, the dimension warp linking you straight into the heart of a star, the flaming sword that burns all the way down to the pommel. Sooner juggle torches in a tar pit than mess with real magic. Sooner lie down in front of 1,000 elephants. At least, that's what wizards say, which is why they charge such swingingly huge fees for getting involved with the bloody stuff. But down here, in the dark tunnels, there was no hiding behind amulets and starry robes and pointy hats. Down here, you either had it, or you didn't. And if you hadn't got it, you'd had it. There were sounds from behind the heavily barred doors as the librarian shuffled along. Once or twice something heavy threw itself against a door, making the hinges rattle. There were noises. The orangutan stopped in front of an arched doorway that was blocked with a door made not of wood but of stone, balanced so that it could easily be opened from the outside but could withstand massive pressure from within. He paused for a moment and then reached into a little alcove and removed a mask of iron and smoked glass, which he put on, and a pair of heavy leather gloves reinforced with steel mesh. There was also a torch made of oil-soaked rags. He lit this from one of the flickering braziers in the tunnel. At the back of the alcove was a brass key. He took the key, and then he took a deep breath. All the books of power had their own particular natures. The octavo was harsh and imperious. The bumper fun grimoire went in for deadly practical jokes. The joy of tantric sex had to be kept under iced water. The librarian knew them all, and how to deal with them. This one was different. Usually people saw only 10th or 12th-hand copies, as like the real thing as a painting of an explosion was to an explosion. This was a book that had absorbed the sheer graphite-grey evil of its subject matter. Its name was hacked in letters over the arch, lest men and apes forget. Necrotelecomnicon. He put the key in the lock and offered up a prayer to the gods.
Ook,
he said fervently.
Ook.
The door swung open. In the darkness within, a chain gave a faint clink.
She's still breathing, said Victor.
Laddie leapt around them, barking furiously.
Maybe you should loosen her clothing or something, said Gaspode.
Oh, it's just a thought, he added.
You don't have to glare at me like that. I'm a dog. What do I know?
She seems all right, but look at her hands, said Victor. What the hell's she been trying to do?
Trying to open that door, said Gaspode.
What door?
That door there.
Part of the hill had slipped away. Huge blocks of masonry protruded from the sand. There were the stubs of ancient pillars sticking up like fluoridated teeth. Between two of them was an arched doorway 3 times as high as Victor. It was sealed with a pair of pale grey doors, either of stone or of wood that had become as hard as stone over the years. One of them was slightly open, but had been prevented from opening further by the drifts of sand in front of it. Frantically scrabbled furrows had been dug deep into the sand. Ginger had been trying to shift it with her bare hands.
"Stupid thing to do in this heat," said Victor, vaguely.
He looked from the door to the sea and then down at Gaspode. Laddie scrambled up the sand and barked excitedly at the crack between the doors.
"What's he doing that for?" said Victor, suddenly feeling spooked. "All his hair is standing up. You don't think he's got one of those mysterious animal premonitions of evil, do you?"
"I think he's a pillock," said Gaspode. "Laddie, shut up!"
There was a yelp. Laddie recoiled from the door, lost his balance on the shifting sand, and rolled down the slope. He leapt to his feet and started barking again, not ordinary stupid dog barking this time, but the genuine treed cat variety. Victor leaned forward and touched the door. It felt very cold, despite the perpetual heat of Holywood, and there was just a faint suspicion of vibration. He ran his fingers over the surface. There was a roughness there, as though there had been a carving that had been worn into obscurity over the years.
"A door like that," said Gaspode behind him, "a door like that, if you want my opinion, a door like that,"
he took a deep breath,
"bodes."
"Hm? What? Bodes what?"
"It don't have to bode anything," said Gaspode, "just basic bodingness is bad enough, take it from me."
"It must have been important."
"Looks a bit temple-ish," said Victor.
"Why'd she want to open it?"
"Bits of cliff sliding down and mysterious doors appearing," said Gaspode, shaking his head. "That's a lot of boding. Let's go somewhere far away and really think about it, eh?"
Ginger gave a groan. Victor crouched down.
"What'd she say?"
"Dunno," said Gaspode.
"It sounded like, I want to be alone, I thought."
"Daft. Touch of the sun there, I reckon," said Gaspode, knowledgeably.
"Maybe you're right. Her head certainly feels very hot."
He picked her up, staggering a little under the weight.
"Come on," he managed. "Let's get down into the town. It'll be getting dark soon."
He looked around at the stunted trees. The door lay in a sort of hollow, which presumably caught enough dew to make the growth there slightly less desiccated than elsewhere.
"You know, this place looks familiar," he said. "We did our first click here. It's where I first met her."
"Very romantic," said Gaspode distantly, hurrying away with Laddie bounding happily around him. "If something horrible comes out of that door, you can think of it as our monster."
"Hey, wait!
Hurry up, then!"
"What would she want to be alone for, do you think?"
"Beats me."
After they'd gone, silence poured back into the hollow. A little later the sun set. Its long light hit the door, turning the merest scratches into deep relief. With the help of imagination, they might just have formed the image of a man with a sword. There was the faintest of noises as, grain by grain, sand trickled away from the door. By midnight, it had opened by at least a 1/16 of an inch. Holywood dreamed. It dreamed of waking up. Ruby damped down the fires under the vats, put the benches on the tables, and prepared to shut the blue lias. But just before blowing out the last lamp, she hesitated in front of the mirror. He'd been waiting out there again tonight, just like every night. He'd been in during the evening, grinning to himself. He was planning something. Ruby had been taking advice from some of the girls who worked in the cliques, and in addition to her feather boa, she'd now invested in a broad-rimmed hat with some sort of ugra, cherries she thought they were called, in it. She'd been assured that the effect was stunning. The trouble, she had to admit, was that he was, well, a very hunky troll. For millions of years, troll women had been naturally attracted to trolls built like a monolith with an apple on top. Ruby's treacherous instincts were firing messages up her spine, insidiously insisting that in those long fangs and bandy legs was everything a troll girl could wish for in a mate. Trolls like Rock or Morrie, of course, were far more modern and could do things like use a knife and fork. But there was something, well, reassuring about Detritus. Perhaps it was the way his knuckles touched the ground so dynamically. And apart from anything else, she was sure she was brighter than he was. There was a sort of gormless unstoppability about him that she found rather fascinating. That was the instincts at work again. Intelligence has never been a particularly valuable survival trait in a troll. And she had to admit that whatever she might attempt in the way of feather boas and fancy hats, she was pushing 140, and was 400 pounds above the fashionable weight. If only he'd buck his ideas up, or at least buck one idea up. Maybe this makeup the girls had been talking about could be worth a try. She sighed, blew out the lamp, opened the door, and stepped out into a maze of roots. A gigantic tree stretched the whole length of the alley. He must have dragged it for miles. The few surviving branches poked through the windows or waved forlornly in the air. In the middle of it all was Detritus, perched proudly on the trunk, his face split in a watermelon grin, his arms spread wide.
"Thriller!"
he said. Ruby heaved a gigantic sigh. Romance wasn't easy when you were a troll. The librarian forced the page open and chained it down. The book tried to snap at him. Its contents had made it what it was, evil and treacherous. It contained forbidden knowledge. Well, not actually forbidden. No one had ever gone so far as forbidding it. Apart from anything else, in order to forbid it, you'd have to know what it was, which was forbidden. But it definitely contained the sort of information which, once you knew it, you wished you hadn't. The Necrotelecomnicon was written by a Clachian necromancer known to the world as Ahmed the Mad, although he preferred to be called Ahmed the I Just Get These Headaches. It is said that the book was written in one day after Ahmed drank too much of the strange, thick Clachian coffee, which doesn't just sober you up, but takes you through sobriety and out the other side, so that you glimpse the real universe beyond the clouds of warm self-delusion that sapient life usually generates around itself to stop it turning into a nutcake. Little is known about his life prior to this event, because the page headed About the Author spontaneously combusted shortly after his death. However, a section headed Other Books by the Same Author indicates that his previous published work was Ahmed the I Just Get These Headaches Book of Humorous Cat Stories, which might explain a lot. Legend said that any mortal man who read more than a few lines of the original copy would die insane. This was certainly true. Legend also said that the book contained illustrations that would make a strong man's brain dribble out of his ears. This was probably true, too. Legend went on to say that merely opening the Necrotelecomnicon would cause a man's flesh to crawl off his hand and up his arm. No one actually knew if this was true, but it sounded horrible enough to be true, and no one was about to try any experiments. Legend had a lot to say about the Necrotelecomnicon, in fact, but absolutely nothing to say about orangutans, who could tear the book into little bits and chew it, for all Legend cared. The worst that had ever happened to the librarian after looking at it was a mild migraine and a touch of eczema. But that was no reason to take chances. He adjusted the smoked glass of the visor and ran one black leather finger down the index. The words bridled as the digit slid past and tried to bite it. Occasionally he'd hold the strip of film up to the light of the flickering torch. The wind and sand had blurred them, but there was no doubt that there were carvings on the rock. And the librarian had seen designs like that before. He found the reference he was looking for, and after a brief struggle, during which he had to threaten the Necrotelecomnicon with the torch, forced the book to turn the page. He peered closer. "Good old Ahmed, the I just get these headaches. And in that hill, it is said, a door out of the world was found, and people of the city watched what was seen therein, knowing not that dread waited between the universes." The librarian's fingertip dragged from right to left across the pictures and skipped to the next paragraph. "For others found the gate of holy wood, and fell upon the world, and in 190 all manner of madnessy befell, and chaos prevailed, and the city sank beneath the sea, and all became one with the fishes and the lobsters, save for the few who fled." He curled a lip and looked further down the page. "A golden warrior who drove the fiends back and saved the world and said, 'Where the gate is, there am I also. I am he that was born of holy wood, to guard the wild idea.' And they said, 'What must we do to destroy the gate forever?' And he said unto them, 'This you cannot do, for it is not a thing. But I will guard the gate for you.' And they, not having been born yesterday, and fearing the cure more than the malady, said to him, 'What will you take from us that you will guard the door?' And he grew until he was the height of a tree, and said, 'Only your remembrance, that I do not sleep. 3 times a day will you remember Holywood, else the cities of the world will tremble and fall, and you will see the greatest of them all in flames.' And with that the golden man took up his golden sword, and went into the hill, and stood at the gate forever. And the people said to one another, 'Funny, he looks just like my Uncle Osbert.'" The librarian turned the page. "But there were among them humans and animals alike, those touched by the magic of Holywood. It goeth through the generations like an ancient curse, until the priests cease in their remembrance, and the golden man sleepeth. Then let the world beware." The librarian let the book snap shut. It wasn't an uncommon legend. He'd read it before, at least had read most of it, in books considerably less dangerous than this. You came across variants in all the cities of the Stowe Plain. There had been a city once in the mists of prehistory, bigger than Ankh-Morpork, if that were possible, and the inhabitants had done something, some sort of unspeakable crime, not just against mankind or the gods, but against the very nature of the universe itself, which had been so dreadful that it had sunk beneath the sea one stormy night. Only a few people had survived to carry to the barbarian peoples in the less advanced parts of the disk all the arts and crafts of civilization, such as usury and macrame. No one had ever really taken it seriously. It was just one of those usual, if you don't stop it, you'll go blind myths that civilizations tend to hand on to their descendants. After all, Ankh-Morpork itself was generally considered as wicked a city as you could hope to find in a year of shore leaves, and seemed to have avoided any kind of supernatural vengeance, although it was always possible that it had taken place and no one had noticed. Legend had always put the nameless city far away and long ago. No one knew where it was, or even if it had existed. The librarian glared at the symbols again. They were very familiar. They were on the old ruins all over Holywood. Azrael stood on a low hill, watching the sea of elephants move below him. Here and there a supply wagon bobbed between the dusty grey bodies like a rudderless boat. A mile of veldt was being churned into a soggy mud wallow, bare of grass, although by the smell of it, it'd be the greenest patch on the disk after the rains came. He dabbed at his eyes with the corner of his robe. 363. Who'd have thought it? The air was solid with the peaked trumpeting of 363 elephants. And with the hunting and trapping parties already going on ahead, there should be plenty more. According to Mbu, anyway. And he wasn't going to argue. Funny that. For years he'd thought of Mbu as a sort of mobile smile, a handy lad with a brush and a shovel, but not what you might call a major achiever.
And then suddenly, someone somewhere wanted 1,000 elephants, and the lad had raised his head and a gleam had come into his eye, and you could see that under that grin was a skilled chylopachydermatalist, ready to answer the call. Funny, you could know someone for their whole life and not realize that the gods had put them into this world to move 1,000 elephants around the place. Azrael had no sons. He'd already made up his mind to leave everything to his assistant. Everything he had at this point amounted to 363 elephants and a ha-ha-ha, a mammoth overdraft. But it was the thought that counted. M'Bu trotted up the path towards him, his clipboard held firmly under one arm.
"Everything ready, boss," he said. "You just got to say the word."
Azrael drew himself up. He looked around at the heaving plain, the distant baobab trees, the purple mountains. Oh yes, the mountains. He'd had misgivings about the mountains. He'd mentioned them to M'Bu, who'd said, "We'll cross them bridges when we get to 'em, boss." And when Azrael had pointed out that there weren't any bridges, he had looked him squarely in the eye and said firmly, "First we build them bridges, then we cross 'em." Far beyond the mountains was the Circle Sea and Ankh-Morpork, and this holy wood place, faraway places with strange-sounding names. A wind blew across the veldt, carrying faint whispers even here. Azrael raised his staff.
"It's 1,500 miles to Ankh-Morpork," he said. "We've got 363 elephants, 50 carts of forage, the monsoon's about to break, and we're wearing sort of things like glass, only dark glass things on our eyes."
His voice trailed off, his brow furrowed as if he'd just been listening to his own voice and hadn't understood it. The air seemed to glitter. He saw M'Bu staring at him. He shrugged.
"Let's go," he said.
M'Bu cupped his hands. He spent all night working out the order of the march.
"Blue section belong Uncle N'Gru. Forward," he shouted. "Yellow section belong Auntie Gugul. Forward. Green section belong second cousin Kik. Forward."
An hour later, the veldt in front of the low hill was deserted except for a billion flies and one dung beetle who couldn't believe his luck. Something went plop on the red dust, throwing up a little crater. And again. And again. Lightning split the trunk of a nearby baobab. The rains began. Victor's back was beginning to ache. Carrying young women to safety looked a good idea on paper, but had major drawbacks after the first 100 yards. "Have you any idea where she lives?" he said. "And is it somewhere close?"
"No idea," said Gaspode.
"She once said something about it being over a clothes shop," said Victor.
"That'll be in the alley alongside Borgles, then," said Gaspode.
Gaspode and Laddie led the way through the alleys and up a rickety outside staircase. Maybe they smelled out Ginger's room. Victor wasn't going to argue with mysterious animal senses. Victor went up the back stairs as quietly as possible. He was dimly aware that where people stayed was often infested by the common or greatly suspicious landlady, and he felt that he had enough problems as it was. He used Ginger's feet to push open the door. It was a small room, low-ceilinged and furnished with the sad, washed-out furniture found in rented rooms across the multiverse. At least, that's how it had started out. What it was furnished with now was Ginger. She had saved every poster, even those from early clicks, when she was just in very small print as a girl. They were thumb-tacked to the walls. Ginger's face and his own stared at him from every angle. There was a large mirror at one end of the pokey room, and a couple of half-burned candles in front of him. Victor deposited the girl carefully on the narrow bed, and then stared around him very carefully. His 6th, 7th, and 8th senses were screaming at him. He was in a place of magic. "It's like a sort of temple," he said. "A temple to herself."
"It gives me the willies," said Gaspode.
Victor stared. Maybe he'd always successfully avoided being awarded the pointy hat and the big staff. But he had acquired wizard instincts. He had a sudden vision of a city under the sea, with octopuses curling stealthily through the drowned doorways and lobsters watching the streets.
"Fate don't like it when people take up more space than they ought to. Everyone knows that."
"I'm going to be the most famous person in the whole world," thought Victor. "That's what she said."
He shook his head.
"No," he said aloud. "She just likes the posters. It's just ordinary vanity."
It didn't sound believable, even to him. The room fairly hummed with... With what? He hadn't felt anything like it before. Power of some sort, certainly. Something that was brushing tantalizingly against his senses. Not exactly magic, at least not the kind he was used to, but something that seemed similar while not being the same. Like sugar compared with salt. The same shape and the same colour, but... Ambition wasn't magical. Powerful, yes, but not magical, surely. Magic wasn't difficult. That was the big secret that the whole baroque edifice of wizardry had been set up to conceal. Anyone with a bit of intelligence and enough perseverance could do magic, which was why the wizards cloaked it with rituals and the whole pointy hat business. The trick was to do magic and get away with it. Because it was as if the human race was a field of corn and magic helped the users to grow just that bit taller so that they stood out. That attracted the attention of gods and, Victor hesitated, other things outside this world. People who used magic without knowing what they were doing usually came to a sticky end. All over the entire room, sometimes. He pictured Ginger back on the beach. I want to be the most famous person in the whole world. Perhaps that was something new, come to think of it. Not ambition for gold or power or land or all the things that were familiar parts of the human world. Just ambition to be yourself, as big as possible. Not ambition for, but to be. He shook his head. He was just in some room, in some cheap building, in some town that was about as real as well as the thickness of a click. It wasn't the place to have thoughts like this. The important thing was to remember that Holy Wood wasn't a real place at all. He stared at the posters again. You just get one chance, she said. You live for maybe 70 years, and if you're lucky, you get one chance. Think of all the natural skiers who are born in deserts. Think of all the genius blacksmiths who were born hundreds of years before anyone invented the horse. All the skills that are never used. All the wasted chances. How lucky for me, he thought, gloomily, that I happen to be alive at this time. Ginger turned over in her sleep. At least her breathing was more regular now. Come on, said Gaspard. It's not right, you being alone in a lady's boudoir. I'm not alone, Victor said. She's with me. That's the point, said Gaspard. Woof, Laddie added, loyally. You know, said Victor, following the dogs down the stairs, I'm beginning to feel there's something wrong here. There's something going on, and I don't know what it is. Why was she trying to get into the hill?
Probably in league with the dread powers, said Gaspard.
The city and the hill and the old book and everything, said Victor, ignoring this. It all makes sense if only I knew what was connecting it. He stepped out into the early evening, into the lights and noise of Holywood. Tomorrow we'll go up there in daylight and sort this out once and for all, he said.
No, we won't, said Gaspard. The reason being, tomorrow we're going to Ankh-Morpork, remember?
We, said Victor. Ginger and I are going. I didn't know about you.
Laddie going too, said Gaspard.
Good boy, laddie.
Yeah, yeah. I heard the trainer say, so I've got to go with him to see he don't get into any trouble style of thing.
Victor yawned. Well, I'm going to go to bed. We'll probably have to start early. Gaspard looked innocently up and down the alley. Somewhere a door opened and there was the sound of drunken laughter. I thought I might have a bit of a stroll before turning in, he said.
Sure, laddie.
Laddie, good boy.
The sights and that.
Victor looked doubtful. Don't keep him out too late, he said. People will worry.
Yeah, right, said Gaspard. Good night.
He sat and watched Victor wander off. He said under his dreadful breath. Catch anyone worrying about me. He glared up at Laddie, who sprang to obedient attention.
Right, young fellow, me pup, he said. It's time you got educated. Lesson one, glomming free drinks in bars. Lucky for you, he added, that you met me.
Two canine shapes staggered uncertainly up the midnight street.
We're poor little lambs, Gaspard howled. What have lost our way?
Woof, 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 woof.
We're little lost shapes, what have...
Gaspard sagged down and scratched an ear, or at least where he vaguely thought an ear might be. His leg waved uncertainly in the air. Laddie gave him a sympathetic look. It had been an amazingly successful evening. Gaspard had always got his free drinks by simply sitting and staring intently at people until they got uncomfortable, and poured him some beer in a saucer, in the hope that he would drink it and go away. It was slow and tedious, but as a technique it had served him well. Whereas Laddie did tricks. Laddie could drink out of bottles. Laddie could bark the numbers of fingers people held up. So could Gaspard, of course, but it had never occurred to him that such an activity could be rewarded. Laddie could home in on young women who were being taken out for the evening by a hopeful swain, and lay his head on their lap and give them such a soulful look that the swain would buy him a saucer of beer and a bag of goldfish-shaped biscuits, just in order to impress the prospective loved one. Gaspard had never been able to do that, because he was far too short for laps, and anyway got nothing but disgusted screams if he tried it. He'd sat under the table in perplexed disapproval to begin with, and then in alcoholic perplexed disapproval, because Laddie was generosity itself when it came to sharing saucers of beer. Now, after they'd both been thrown out, Gaspard decided it was time for a lecture in true dogness.
"You don't want to go himblong, omlong, humbling yourself to humans," he said. "It's letting everyone down. We'll never throw off the shackles of dependency on mankind if dogs like you go around being glad to see people the whole time. I was personally disgusted when you did that lying on your back and playing dead routine, let me tell you.
Oof!
You're just a running dog of the human imperialists," said Gaspard severely.
Laddie put his paws over his nose. Gaspard tried to stand up, tripped over his legs, and sat down heavily. After a while, a couple of huge tears coursed down his fur.
"I mean, look at the start I had in life. Thrown in a river in a sack. An actual sack. Dear little puppy dog opens his eyes, looks out in wonder at the world style of thing. He's in this sack."
And tears dripped off his nose.
"For 2 weeks I thought the brick was me mother."
"Oof,"
said Laddie with uncomprehending sympathy.
"Just my luck they threw me in the ark," Gaspard went on. "Any other river, I'd have drowned and gone to doggy heaven. I heard where this big black ghostly dog who comes up to you when you die and says your time has gone. Gone. Gone."
Gaspard stared at nothing much.
"Can't sink in the ark, though," he said thoughtfully. "Very tough river, the ark."
"Oof."
"It shouldn't happen to a dog," said Gaspard, metaphorically.
"Oof!"
Gaspard peered blearily at Laddie's bright, alert, and irrevocably stupid face.
"You don't understand a bloody word I've been saying, do you?"
he muttered.
"Oof!"
said Laddie, begging.
"Lucky bugger," sighed Gaspard.
There was a commotion at the other end of the alley. He heard a voice say,
"There he is! Laddie, here, boy!"
The words dripped relief.
"It's the man," growled Gaspard. "You don't have to go."
"Ooh, ooh, ooh, good boy, Laddie. Laddie, good boy. Oof,"
barked Laddie, trotting forward obediently, if a little unsteadily.
"We've been looking for you everywhere," muttered one of the trainers, raising a stick.
"Don't hit it," said the other trainer. "You'll ruin everything." He peered into the alley and met Gaspard's stare coming the other way.
"That's the flea bag that's been hanging around," he said. "It gives me the creeps."
"Heave something at it," suggested the other man.
The trainer reached down and picked up a stone. When he stood up again, the alley was empty. Drunk or sober, Gaspard had perfect reflexes in certain circumstances. "See," the trainer said, glaring at the shadows, "it's like it's some kind of mind reader."
"Oh, it's just a mutt," said his companion.
"Don't worry about it. Come on, get the leash on this one and let's get him back before Mr. Dibbler finds out."
Laddie followed them obediently back to the sanctuary of the fruit bat, and allowed himself to be chained up to his kennel. Possibly he didn't like the idea, but it was hard to be sure in the network of duties, obligations, and vague emotional shadows that made up what, for want of a better word, had to be called his mind. He pulled experimentally on the chain once or twice, and then lay down awaiting developments. After a while, a small, hoarse voice on the other side of the fence said,
"I could send you a bone with a file in it. Only you'd eat it."
Laddie perked up.
"Ooh, ooh, good boy, Laddie. Ooh, 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 good boy, Gaspard. Ooh."
"Shh, shh. At least they ought to let you speak to a lawyer," said Gaspard. "Chaining someone up's against human rights."
"Ooh."
"Anyway, I'd paid 'em back," I followed the audible one back to his house and piddled all down his front door.
Woof!
Gaspode sighed and waddled away. Sometimes, in his heart of hearts, he wondered whether it wouldn't after all be nice to belong to someone. Not just be owned by them or chained up by them, but actually belong so that you were glad to see them, and carried their slippers in your mouth and pined away when they died, etc. Laddie actually liked that kind of stuff, if you could call it liked. It was more like something built into his bones. Gaspode wondered darkly if this was true dogness, and growled deep in his throat. It wasn't, if he had anything to do with it. Because true dogness wasn't about slippers and walkies and pining for people, Gaspode was sure. Dogness was about being tough, and independent, and mean. Yeah. Gaspode had heard that all canines could interbreed, even back to the original wolves, so that must mean that deep down inside every dog was a wolf. You could make a dog out of a wolf, but you couldn't take the wolf out of a dog. When the hard pad was acting up, and the fleas were feisty and acting full of plumptiousness, it was a comforting thought. Gaspode wondered how you went about mating with a wolf, and what happened to you when you stopped. Well, that didn't matter. What mattered was that true dogs didn't go around going mad with pleasure just because a human said something to them. Yeah. He growled at a pile of trash and dared it to disagree. Part of the pile moved, and a feline face with a defunct fish in its mouth peered out at him. He was just about to bark half-heartedly at it for tradition's sake when it spat the fish out and spoke to him.
Hello, Gaspode.
Gaspode relaxed.
Oh, well, old cat. No offence meant, didn't know it was you.
I hateth fish, said the cat, but at least they don't talk back.
Another part of the trash moved and Squeak the Mouse emerged.
What are you two doing down here? Said Gaspode. I thought you said it was safer on the hill.
Not any more, said the cat. It's getting too spooky.
Gaspode frowned. Yet a cat, he said disapprovingly. You ought to be right alongside the idea of spooky.
But that doesn't extend to having golden sparks crackling off your fur and the ground shaking the whole time, and weird voices that you think must be happening in your own head, said the cat. It's becoming eldritch up there.
So we all came down, said Squeak. Mr. Thumpy and the duck are hiding out in the dunes.
Another cat dropped off the fence beside them. It was large and ginger and not blessed with Holywood intelligence. It stared at the sight of a mouse looking relaxed in the presence of a cat. Squeak nudged Cat on the paw.
Get rid of it, he said.
Cat glared at the newcomer.
Sod off, he said. Go on, beat it. Gods, this is so humiliating.
Not just for you, said Gaspode,
as the new cat trotted away, shaking its head.
If some of the dogs in this town see me chatting to a cat, my street cred is going to go way down.